This episode is brought to you by Hero Forge. There is no better gift for a gamer than a custom miniature of their beloved TTRPG character. So this holiday season, take the guesswork out of gift giving and treat your players to a digital gift card to Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. You can make minis in a variety of materials, including premium unpainted plastic and color standees, and they even offer downloadable model files so you can 3D print your unique designs at home. And for the dice lovers in your party, never fear, Hero Forge has you covered with their custom dice, which lets you put your hero inside the very D20 that will help lead you to glory. Visit heroforge.com to send your players a digital gift card and let them build the heroes of their dreams.
Hey, Brian.
Hey, Elliot.
What's the talk of the table?
Today, we are sitting down with Zach Cox, founder and creative lead of Soul Muppet Publishing and the designer of games like Orbital Blues and Paint the Town Red.
Zach, welcome to the show! Welcome!
Yeah, thank you both so much for having me, guys. I've been on my first dungeon a few times in like talkbacks and session minus ones or whatever you want to call them, but it's good to be here on Talk of the Table.
Yeah, I think we messaged you, or you messaged us, and you were like, hey, I'd love to come on Talk of the Table sometime. And we both messaged back like, haven't you already been on Talk of the Table? And then we looked at our files and we're like, no!
No, we haven't.
But yeah, this is going to be a little different from the other conversations people have heard us have. I mean, on My First Dungeon, we're obviously focused in on a particular game, whether that's Orbital Blues or our season of Paint the Town Red. But today, we actually want to talk to you a little bit more about the business of everything, kind of how you have grown Soul Muppet Publishing, how you've managed that growth as you've moved from crowdfunder to crowdfunder, and why you write and publish games with strong messages, and then kind of just like zooming all out on all of that, and like how do you balance that as a creative and a business person? But I guess the first question is, like, what was the point where Soul Muppet Publishing went from I'm just Zach Cox writing and publishing my own game to this is a business apparatus where now I'm working with multiple people? When did you say like, oh, this is a business, this is going to be a business?
So a lot of the early days of Soul Muppet Publishing, I'm actually like co-founder of Soul Muppet with a guy called Ben Brown, who was the original artist for our game Best Left Buried. I'd written a game, I wanted an illustrator, I knew Ben from going to school with him, and we were kind of working on the games together, whereas in like, I was writing everything, he was doing the art, and then I was doing everything else, right? And that started off as a pretty even trade of labor while he was spending loads of time doing illustrations. And then as things increased and increased in volume, we started doing like crowdfunding and bits of publishing as well. Like, it started being less and less Ben's business, especially because I was too busy doing all of the other stuff to be able to keep up with Ben doing art, right? I was falling behind in terms of all those illustrations. So there was a point there where, like, during the early days of the pandemic, like, Ben and I would have, like, a call once a week on a Saturday, or maybe once every 2 weeks, where I'd be, like, walking around my garden, like, telling him all the stuff I'd done that week, because, like, half of the company was his, and it was his money I was working with. And when we got to that point, I was like, wait a second, this is, like, a whole second job that I'm doing right now, alongside the job of actually writing stuff, which is the fun hobby. So yeah, it was like a very sort of long process, but like when it really felt adult is when like Ben had left Soul Muppet and we'd done sort of a complicated financial buyout, and like the company just sat with me, and when I had to like sit down with an accountant and a lawyer, that's like when it actually felt really businessy. But it's a long time before that. Like, ultimately, these books that are made, while a lot of them are made by big companies and a lot of them are made by like single people doing all the work themselves, there is also a big space in the middle, which is where a lot of other RPGs are made. And Soul Muppet like is firmly in that space where it doesn't feel like a real company. When I get self-conscious about what I'm doing, it is on every metric that could be used to describe it a real company, but it's more than like a sort of hobbyist, you know, job, which is, you know, and a lot of amazing games are made by hobbyists. That's not to speak down anybody's work in the industry, even if you want to call it an industry, a micro industry or a art scene or whatever. Like, there's a lot of stuff happening in a lot of different ways. And yeah, Soul Muppet has just grown and grown and grown to the point where I've got 3 employees now. I don't know like how, and essentially those people exist to free up time for me to do creative work in like the bluntest way possible. The idea is that I can be a sort of roving itinerant project/product manager who gets to do a bit of writing as well. But obviously time management in a business of any size is really, really difficult, especially like in this kind of cottage industry zone. There's always competing needs that have to be kind of managed against each other. Because, you know, if you think about any company, there are a million things that need doing from every like part. And every time you outsource something to either an employee or an external partner or a freelancer, it's another thing that you have to spend money on, you know? So there's like that a really complicated set of decisions about that sort of thing.
And not only spend money on, but also spend, even if you're outsourcing something that will free up time, you have to spend time to like build that so it works properly. Like, you can't just say to someone you hire, like, hey, do this job. It's going to take them a number of months to get up to speed, to be able to do it in a way that is familiar to you and to get your communication on the same track. If only it was just throwing money at something and then the problem was solved. But there's always that long tail of time where it's like, okay, the problem is getting solved.
And you can work with external partners and this kind of stuff. Sometimes those people can be incredibly proficient, but that costs lots of money, right? You know, the more competent someone is, the more money they ask you for. And that's a decision as well. It's like, at what point of like scaling, you know, at what point should my company stop investing in external partners for example, actual play, and start doing it in-house ourselves? You know, there's like an amount of time and experience it takes to get good at something. And obviously, like, lots of decisions exist about like where specialization within industry sits. Like, within Soul Muppet, I keep all of our marketing and e-commerce in-house is like where most of our resource goes. And then a lot of our project management sits with me and a little bit with Eric, who's our operations manager, which essentially means doing whatever I need doing in a given week. Then the idea is that we then work with freelancers and writers and artists and all kinds of other people that are kind of brought in externally to provide expertise for a given project.
I think a good thing to understand where a company is to understand, and where a project is to understand where it's trying to get to. Where do you see Soul Muppet, or where do you hope Soul Muppet is in like a year, 2 years, 5 years? What are your long-term goals for the company, and how are you like trying to make those goals happen with the moves that you're making right now?
A big thing for us in terms of goals is about sustainability. And one of the things that makes running a creative business without external funding from an investor or a parent company difficult is that crowdfunding is very powerful as a tool right now and is a really easy way to get lots of money quickly, but in a way that is unreliable, can create lots of pressure on a company in terms of like, you have to sell the thing and then deliver it 6, 12, 18 months later. And kind of also really spiky revenue. Like, if you think about, with Soul Muppet made a certain amount of money last year and 56% of that money appeared in 2 months, right? Which is when we had the payout for Yin, we had the payout for Afterburn, right? And we are working 363 other days that money doesn't arrive, and 10 months those crowdfunding projects aren't happening, and we are in the mode of like, when's the next crowdfunding thing? What are we doing? What's happening? Like, so I think a big goal for us is to move our reliance away from crowdfunding and push towards like more sustainable business that involves practices of people buying products that actually exist, and for some strange reason involving psychology that the whiz kids at the crowdfunding platforms have managed to work out, it's much harder to sell somebody a product that actually exists rather than the aspirational idea of a product. if you released a, you know, if I released a product tomorrow on my web store, I might be able to sell 100 copies, right? Whereas I could easily sell 5 or 10 times that if it was a graphic, right? And that means that we are like, the language of like addiction is present there. It's like, I'm dependent upon this format. It's also really unhealthy for workers as well, because like 60-70% of the work is clustered into those 2 months. And what if somebody is ill during that period or wants to take a holiday? Or, you know, how does that work around that? And it's also just bad for stress. Like, watching number go up is not pleasant, you know, and having to not think about the number, but knowing that the number is also like your health as a business is really difficult. So like, where I'd like to be in, I would like that number that is currently like 50-60% to be down at around 20-40, right? And the way that that's happening is about building a mailing list, building a relationship with customers about them understanding where the web store is and like knowing to use them, cultivating a really broad range of interesting games that live there, and also working really hard with friendly local gaming stores and distributors to like make sure that our games are available in lots of places, which is a really interesting technical challenge in terms of like relationship management with various types of people who exist at different levels, like discussing which is probably beyond the scope of this consumer-facing podcast. But like, there's lots of stuff that you have to do to make sure that your games are available in a friendly local gaming store. And mostly that is to run through it very quickly, having a consolidator, being friends with distributors, getting FaceTime with different store owners, being able to talk to them, not annoying them, being able to get stock in the right place. And also like the size of the game changes. Because like, if I'm selling a book to a consumer, let's say I sell a copy of Orbital Blues for $40. It cost me $4 to make it. That's a really big profit margin. That's $36 that I get to keep, right? Minus processing fees on my web store, but whatever. It's basically $33, give or take, once you pay for that like 10% fee. Whereas if you're selling it into a game shop, they might be buying that game at between $12 and $18, depending on if they bought it from me direct or if they are purchasing it for a different company at like different stages. So if I'm selling that book for $8 to $12 profit rather than $33, right? That really changes the I have to sell more books to like push them through that space. So that's like a real change, but also it means that I'm selling more books so I can print more books, which means things are cheaper. Like, there's all this stuff, and like, I'm really sorry that like my aspirational goals in terms of like where I'd like the company to be is like, I'd like to not have to worry about crowdfunding. Like, even though crowdfunding is incredibly exciting, there's stuff I want as well. Like, I'd like to have an accountant on staff so I don't have to think about my taxes. You know, that'd be fun. I'd really like an in-person office, like a Soul Muppet HQ somewhere. And like with a big, you know, plushy Sammy the Soul Muppet, I don't know. But like the actual real goal is I'd like to be less stressed about how much money my next crowdfunding project is going to make. I'd like more reliable income.
Honestly, all those things match up really well with what we're feeling at Many Sided Media of like the things that we want are ways to be sustainable. And I think we're coming in with very similar things of a lot of the money that we get in are from like sponsorships from publishing companies like you or like MythWorks and stuff. And those are difficult things to procure. Like there's a lot of work that goes into them. There's a lot of time. Like beforehand, you've got to A, convince someone that this is a worthwhile investment. And like every company that we talk to has their own things that they're very concerned about. Like they want to make sure that this is an investment that helps them in the long term. As much as it is nice to think that people should just like give money to artists to make things, I don't think this industry can really financially support that yet. Like it does need to have some kind of return on investment. And the thing that we're looking at as well is like trying to find ways to be more sustainable, whether that's through like our ad revenue being more consistent, our Patreon growing, because that's like a very consistent revenue stream. All those little things then take the pressure off of needing to find that next like big sponsor for a thing and allows us the freedom to choose a game that doesn't have a sponsor, choose a game that we want to play for 30 episodes or whatever. It kind of opens up the world to us to be able to do a lot more stuff that we maybe want to do or new things that we want to try, because we're not seeking these like these big like Kickstarter moments in your terms. I think that is the goal of everyone working in this industry, is just sustainability. And honestly, I agree with you. A fucking office would be great. I'd love to have a place that I could actually have a recording booth in.
Oh yeah,
that's probably reasonably difficult in Manhattan, right? I imagine office space is quite expensive. But
we know some podcasters who have like an office in Brooklyn. I'm like, how much does that cost? We definitely can't get there now, but I would love to do that in the near future.
It's interesting, this like I totally on a smaller scale relate to the chasing the crowdfunding dragon, from crowdfunder to crowdfunder, is how the revenue of more blueberries exists right now too. And I think that like one of the things that we have to deal with in that is this idea of like everybody has trouble with Kickstarter, and then BackerKit emerges and people see the appeal of switching to BackerKit. But I know that like from your perspective, like you've gone back and forth. Now you went to BackerKit for Paint the Town Red, and now you're back to Kickstarter for Mad as Hell. And I'm curious if you're open to talking about kind of what that experience is like and why the return to Kickstarter, what that means for you as a business.
So BackerKit's a really interesting company. I like working with them a lot. We use them consistently for our pledge managers and advertising management. Got a really great relationship with the BackerKit team. And they're always making new features. They're much more feature aggressive than Kickstarter historically has been. We've ran Paint the Town Red on there as an experiment, frankly. And that was a quite small crowdfunding campaign for us, which was a bit of a disappointment. Like, it didn't do as well as I expected it to do. That's okay. Not everything does. Like I said, that's the problem with crowdfunding in general. Like, not everything is going to resonate with the audience as well as it's going to resonate with you or what your business plan is, right? You can never know how anything's going to work, even if it's not on a crowdfunding platform. I think that BackerKit is a really good space to run projects which you have an existing audience for. I think their marketing tools are really good. Their pledge management system is leagues ahead of the Kickstarter one. And they're also really aggressive on trust and safety in terms of like looking after you as a person running the project, protecting you from harassment and stuff like that, you know, because there can often be problems with that on Kickstarter, especially with super backers. Sometimes they can have opinions. Honestly, I'm moving back, and I tried it initially because what I want is data. Like, I can look at other people's projects and see how they're doing and how they've been received by the community and by the number. But also, I can't tell that using one project. I think what I'll be doing for the next couple of years is probably like alternating between different systems. I think that the main advantage of Kickstarter over BackerKit is simply in terms of like the fact that it is the industry name for the thing, and people browse Kickstarter for RPG projects. I do not think that browsing audience of super backers exists on BackerKit yet. It might in a few years, but right now that's where those people are. When we were looking at the numbers on the projects, we could see that retention of... We had a fine first couple of days, but after that, we were relying on advertising to drive people to look at the product page, whereas on Kickstarter, people will just browse it. I think we'll be moving back and forth. I want to try a few more things. Just like because I'm back on Kickstarter doesn't mean I'll never use BackerKit again, you know, and I'm going to continue using BackerKit for their pledge manager and ads services because they're really good for that. But it's a really complicated and nuanced decision. And like, just because that one project didn't do as well as I hoped, I don't know if that's something to do with me misunderstanding my audience, like the audience misunderstanding the game, the, you know, people's perception of how stuff happens. Like, it's an incredibly, like, capturing the lightning zeitgeist of a multi-massive, huge, explosive crowdfunding project is alchemy. And even as someone who's run like 15 crowdfunding projects, I still do not really understand what is happening, and I cannot approach anything with any confidence. So one data point of this didn't do what I needed is like essentially useless unless I can understand more about what's happening within that space. So we'll be back at some point, but I don't know when, I don't know how, and it depends how the next couple of Kickstarter projects do for us.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's like I've now run four crowdfunding, so a significant chunk less and at significant smaller values. But it is like every piece of data is important. Like every piece of data is important, and yet I have all this data, and sometimes I still am like, well, I don't know what's going to work or like what's going to catch that, you know, that thing. It's like I know certain things that I will always do, but it's like I don't necessarily know what that like combination of alchemy is that's going to mean that, oh yeah, we make the income we need to make for this half of the year.
Yeah, as a former data scientist, data is both useless and useful.
Yeah.
Depending on the day and the thing you're trying to work out, you know.
Yeah, it sounds about right. So you talked about sustainability being like your big goal for the foreseeable future. What do you think the hurdles are that you're facing that will prevent you from getting there? And what do you think the steps are that you are currently making and want to make in the future that will get you closer to that goal?
Yeah. So the main obstacle is mainly just a marketing and consumer behavior job, right? It is talking to people about our games and making people aware of them, right? And making sure they know how to buy them and there's as many places as possible that they are available. It's a platform angling issue, right? There needs to be the website, which has to be a place to get as many things as possible. There needs to be lots of places for PDFs. There needs to be a strong relationship with game stores and distributors. And after you've done all those things, you need to be able to talk to the consumer about all those things to make them sit in the right direction. Ultimately, I think that the other challenge is just uncertainty, right? For example, I don't know if anybody's reading the news lately, but your good old president, fist pumps the air, is making people quite difficult, making it quite difficult to run a game store at the moment and making it quite difficult to import anything manufactured in China. I think as we are currently recording, tariffs on Chinese goods are currently at 245%.
245.
Yeah. It's effectively an embargo,
right? Yeah. That is like you cannot realistically import anything. And that means that games will need to cost roughly 3.5 times what they do currently, right? You need to make the same amount of money on them, right? If you take that £4 Orbital Blues book, which I'm selling for $12 to $80 into US retail, and then you add, $9 onto it, right? That doesn't make sense anymore. $10 on £4, on $4 rather. Again, I'm having to use dollars rather than my native, not freedom currency.
Freedom currency, wow. Yeah.
If I have to pay $10 on top of a $4 book, that £12 I'm selling it for no longer makes sense. In fact, I'm losing money, right? The good news about that is that right now, books are exempt under exemptions for educational purposes. And also, I do not make my books in China. But the thing you would notice if you went into any game store in the continental United States is that the stuff that is on the shelves there is not copies of Orbital Blues. It is copies of board games. And board games are manufactured in China. And if those board games lose revenue and go out of business, that impedes not only like direct sales that I can make through to game players, to consumers. I also lose like the most valuable tool in the arsenal of somebody like me, which is an enthusiastic member of staff shoving a copy of Paint the Town Red or Orbital Blues or whatever into someone's hands and telling them it's this amazing game about sad gay vampires, right? Because at a convention, I can do that, but there is not one of me on every street corner in the continental United States, right? Whereas there are 3 board game cafes in every city with 10,000 people in it, right? Or town or whatever, you know? And that's not the number, but there's lots of stores in America. And I'm worried about what's going to happen to them over the next couple months. And while currently Europe is relatively unaffected and, you know, books are also unaffected, this man does not understand the problems facing us specifically that he creates by, you know, machismally arguing with, you know, starting trade wars. Like, he doesn't understand how that's affecting normal people or doesn't care. You know, I don't know which is more accurate. or in fact, the thing that is happening right now is his stated explicit goal, but that's neither here nor there. And dealing with that uncertainty makes like planning a shift away from crowdfunding scary, right? But also, it's particularly dangerous during crowdfunding because if I sell you a book on my web store, I'm reasonably certain I can get it to you before a new tariff rate is implemented that means I have to pay more money, right? Whereas if I do a crowdfunding project and it's delayed, it takes me 6 to 18 months to deliver it, we could be at 3,000% tariffs by that point.
The world is a very different place in 6 months.
A very different place in 18 months, you know, especially with all kinds of scary stuff blooming. So like, that's the challenge right now. It's like the fact that ultimately 60 to 70% of my customer base is in the US, and that is an extremely fractious and challenged economy, never mind a political...
hellscape.
Let me get the right word here. yeah, never mind a political hellscape. You know, it's not great. And like making art under those conditions is pretty hard as well. So, you know, we'll see. But there are games written by Solopit about how angry we are with capitalism, you know? And I think that wanting to be able to, like you wouldn't listen to the podcast I've just given you and probably clock that like, I am an avowed left-wing person who believes we should all have universal basic income and that currency maybe shouldn't exist, you know?
Yeah.
Like, that's probably quite hard to tell from the way I talk about business practices and data science, but the board that we live on has forced me to play a certain way. I'd love to make art that doesn't care about financial need, right? Someone asked me the other day, what I would do with my life if what I wanted about the economy and the world to be better. And all my friends were like, oh, I'd go live in the woods and start a farm or, you know, live by the sea and write poetry and brew potions. And I was like, I'd just do this, but I wouldn't need to be scared all the time.
Right. Yeah. You wouldn't be stressed. Yeah.
Like, I would be stressed because I could just make shit and, you know, not worry about what part of the global economy is going to blow up next week, you know? Like, it would be much simpler, but you got to play with the card hand you dealt. Is that the same? I don't know. You got to play cards, I've heard. Cards are good.
You got to just play cards.
Play cards. That's the same, right?
This episode is brought to you by Hero Forge. There is no better gift for a gamer than a custom miniature of their beloved TTRPG character. So this holiday season, take the guesswork out of gift giving and treat your players to a digital gift card to Hero Forge. Hero Forge offers fully customizable tabletop miniatures with dozens of fantasy species and thousands of parts to choose from, all within your browser. You can make minis in a variety of materials, including premium unpainted plastic and color standees, and they even offer downloadable model files so you can 3D print your unique designs at home. And for the dice lovers in your party, never fear, Hero Forge has you covered with their custom dice, which lets you put your hero inside the very D20 that will help lead you to glory. Visit heroforge.com to send your players a digital gift card and let them build the heroes of their dreams.
The Badlands. Legend has it that beneath the dust, something old and powerful still whispers to any gunslinger foolish enough to listen. One day, aboard a doomed train into the wastes, three unlucky travelers hear that call. A runaway socialite, a shape-shifting bounty hunter, and a retired thief turned family man. Will our outcasts find what they're looking for?
I mean, we're already here. Let's have a little fun.
You really went in there, guns blazing.
I thought that was the plan.
My potions are
miraculous.
I thought we were being quiet.
Oh, Stump only has one volume. Sorry.
Wild roses grow out of his mouth, having filled his lungs.
What's happening out there?
Violence.
Find out on Mage Hand High Five.
Speaking of playing cards, and I'm going to make this segue work. One of the things that I think you have done well as a company and like as a creative and as a product manager is investing in a game's like long-term success. And I think that one of the ways you do that is like Orbital Blues Afterburn. I think another way is, especially prescient for me, is you invested in a solo game for Orbital Blues, which used cards. That's where I was going. There's the connection. All right. How do you think about...
Honestly, Elliot, I saw the segue the moment you said cards. And I was like, is that the move you're
going
to go
going.
For?
That's the move he's going for.
Okay, yeah. Okay,
yeah,
cool.
Yeah.
No, it was a long road
I do
to
this
get
professionally.
There.
Yeah. How do you think about investing in a game long-term? Like, kind of, it is, I think, both a creative thought and a business thought.
Oh, yeah, totally. I think that the most critical thing is that, like... And I've always thought this about games, right, in general. I don't know about you, but I've got quite a lot of games in my house. And I play quite a lot of games, but I don't play most of the games I own, right? And ultimately, if I can get you to buy a PDF or a book, right, from a selfish, mercantile perspective, I have your $40, $20, £10, whatever it is, right? If I can get you to play my game, and sit down and enjoy, read, not only read it, because reading the thing is a challenge to start, but that just like having a good pitch. But like making a game that is easy to access and easy to play is like step one for convincing your friends to get them to play it with you, right? Character creation has to be simple. The game has to be easy to read, has to look beautiful, has to be joyful to read because that incites play. And I think that ultimately any game that I have sold someone, even if I have their money, if they've not played it, I have at least a little bit in my anxious heart failed, right? I think that play, I'm a play supremacist. I think that it's the point of the game. And while it is wonderful that you can make RPGs that are about opening the mind to imagination and making something that's meant to be read rather than played or something that's meant to be enjoyed as a piece of quasi-literature, that is to me ancillary. And what I want is for play to occur. A lot of the time, that is about making games that are accessible in terms of only needing D6s is something we push towards a lot. You don't need a polyhedral set to play any of the Soul Muppet games. You might need it to roll on a table, but you can do that from random number generator or just picking from it. A lot of the time it is making character creation really simple. Most of the Soul Muppet games, as you guys will know, focus on having rules that get out of the way and lead to really impactful storytelling. I don't want a rule that makes you think that I'm smart. I want a game that has rules that make you think that I've got your back as the GM, right? I'm going to be your friend. I'm going to help you run or play this game. And I think solo games are a really important part of that strategy because ultimately, like, I'm the first to admit I am not a solo game player. I have not played a solo game, I think, ever. I own lots of solo games, but they are games that have failed play supremacy in my idea, to me specifically, because... And I said this to Dylan once, and I think they shouted at me. And I think he said, if I'm writing something and it's not going in a book, I failed because it needs to go in the book. And that's where the thing is. And Dylan was like, no, Zach, that's so unhealthy. You need to like play games for fun. But ultimately, solo games are about lowering that accessibility, right? Because some people have access to games, but not to people always, especially... times, scheduling, whatever. I've got lots of tips on scheduling RPG sessions, but ultimately, if a solo game is your spiel, you should be able to do that. I think one of the strengths of the Soul Muppets / More Blueberries solo games of Orbital Blues and Paint the Town Red is that they act as like prep tools for playing the full game, like making a backstory in the case of the Wanderer solo game. And in terms of the yet to be released, but just laid out excitingly, Morning After, that is like a prep for GMs to like help them build a city. So those are like really useful as tools. and are things that, when they are played, are likely to then elicit further play from Seth. So to me, I treat every Soul Muppet game like it is the most beautiful toolbox you own that is about giving you stuff that is going to, while it looks good on a coffee table, its actual use is to have out at a table where you're playing a game and it wants to push you towards gameplay with all the speed and veracity that it can.
I feel like for me, the first game I experienced that was a Soul Muppet game was Orbital Blues. And I remember picking that up. I was like, I don't know what this is fully yet. But by the time I flipped through like three pages, I was like, I have to play this.
Yeah.
It's just like it has to have that inviting. And then, like, you know, the more you learn about that game, you're like, oh, it's a very simple system. You've got all these cool tools, you know, Upper Hand, Against the Odds. You know, you've got your swan song. You've got, you know, the blues and stuff. The deeper you get into it, the more it just reaffirms your idea that you saw when you first saw the cover in the first couple pages of like, oh, I have to play this.
Yeah. Those books look good, partly because I'm a book freak, right? And I like books that look nice, but also because I want to have you see the thing on the page and have your imagination explode and demand play, right? Aspirational play is fine, but like pushing you towards the idea of like, oh, I can play this. This looks great. This is easy. And like, that's why they're never big. They're always small and manageable. It's why they look like the place they are trying to evoke. That's an important part of layout for me. It wants to carry with it a sense of place. You know, that's true of all the things we've laid out. And there's a lot of like layout working with graphic designers is like something I love. And I also hate because I am a nightmare client to work with, I think. Because I often come to these things with a really strong vision of like what I want the layout to be like and what it sounds like. And then actually, I don't always possess the vocabulary to be able to tell someone what the thing I want means. Like I was working with Jean Verne on Doom Spiral, which is a game that will probably be announced by the time this comes out. But if it's not, we're making a Dark Souls game called Doom Spiral. Enjoy. Souls-like, Dark Souls adjacent, whatever. It's not a Dark Souls game. I don't have a license. And the instruction for layout on that was like, I need this to look like the inside of an abandoned cathedral. Thank you. And like, that, those are my notes, right? And then someone has to make a cathedral, right? And I don't know how to make a book cathedral. Those things don't exist. So it's like pushing that sense of purpose and intensity of genre that projects to you the idea that this is something I could use to have fun because that's what it's for, right? That's what game books do. And I know people who write and make games who do not play games anymore because they are too busy. Or because it feels like work. And I hope none of them are listening right now because it makes me question their integrity. You know, you got to play the games, man. You got to play the games. You can't just make the games. You got to play them. Otherwise, you're gonna lose the understanding of what the thing is. You know,
the play part of your brain will atrophy. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I feel like I was having some of that recently. Of like the only, we kind of made jokes of it, of like the only games I was playing were for podcasts. Of like, we'd talk about doing a home game and be like, but we could just like throw some mics on and make a new show. And now, luckily, I'm in like a number of home games, including an Orbital Blues home game.
Oh.
Yeah, it's fun. I'm playing a ship's owner who's definitely not the actual owner. He's got the gift of gab. So he's very much like used car salesman vibe. And we're playing through Settler System right now, which is great.
Hell yeah.
Hell yeah.
I do want to dig in on your self-proclaimed book sickodom that you live in, because it is one of the things that like I have always loved about your work and like a thing I aspire to, because I also love being a sicko about books. Like we just crowdfunded A Land Once Magic and Viditya and I were like, we got to make this just the most like delicious feeling little book. And I specifically got to hold the Garden of Yin and Stygian Library you had at Gamma, and those are such beautiful little objects. When you go about what is the thing that like happens in your brain when you're like, this is an object that is worth making for me? Like what takes the like game idea to object worth making that you want people to hold.
So at the start, I told myself that people would only want to buy these books if they were beautiful. And that was like my justification, right? I was like, zine, I don't get me wrong, I love a zine. I'm the biggest, I own more zines than anything else. If you give me an A5 staple, I don't mind what it's made of. Like, I still think that's fine. But also, I don't think it's fine. I think it's fucking great. I love a good weird little zine. The more homemade, the better. But the drive for like intensity of product as the idea, and like when I say product, I don't mean like I mean like the objectification and the sort of the beautification of the physical, right, is something that's really important to me. When we started out, I was able to get like 80 to 90% of the way there with just layout, right? But I've become like every project I've done for the last couple years has had some weird thing in it that is not industry standard. Or the blues, it was the cassettes, right? The fact that Chris Bissett made an album for us of music and then it went onto a cassette that is like an in-universe object is like, well, yes, good. LATAM Breakout was a bit more simple on the physical side. That was more like zines. But then with when we did Gangs of Titan City, that came with like one of the alt covers was like bound in book cloth with stencil indented silver pips, which made like a pop art image of a gun. That's like a book technology I have not seen since. You can feel the cover. It's like Braille. When we did Throne of Avarice in the second half of 2022, there was a Grimoire edition of Best Left Buried available, which is when we take a normal Best Left Buried, wrap it in leather, and then like emboss a spade onto it. And like that's something that like we've made 10 off, and they sell for like £250, so like $325. And like people buy those because they're gorgeous. And then when we did Inevitable, that came with a solid metal bullet dice.
Yeah.
I still regret
not getting the bullet dice.
Orbital Blues, that came with more cassettes. The VHS box set adventure collection, Rogue Anthems, which is now available on the SOM website, as well as a slipcase of the compilation of 5 Orbital Blues adventures. And I know a slipcase is like a pretty pedestrian thing to do, but the way that Josh did the design for it is just gorgeous. And 2 more cassettes. There's a reason that project has been quite delayed, because it contained many fancy and complicated things. Then Gardens of Inn are these like incredible cloth bound like things that look like they are pulled from the place they represent, which are these like extra dimensional, extra planar labyrinth dungeon spaces filled with books and flowers respectively. And then with Paint the Town Red, that came with dice with blood in them, because you know. And then Mad as Hell, which is our new game, has 2 holes in it, because we were working with an amazing 3-dimensional collage artist, and I had a phone call with him, and I was like, we're gonna get you as many layers as we can, Alex. And the artist, Alex Edwin-Norm, was like, guys, I'll just do you a book cover. It doesn't need to have holes in it. I was like, yes, it does. I'm here. I'm on my bullshit. Let me cook.
Holes, baby.
And so the final version of that is you can see through to the end papers from the die-cut hardcover. And then there is a die-cut slipcase on top of that, which depicts like the final cover. And again, by the time this comes out, the Kickstarter should be live. And we're going to have available multiple dust jackets that you can swap on and off depending on which one you want to use, each of which is done by a different artist from the interior art of the game.
Wow.
That's fun.
So not only is it a sicko book, it is a modular build your own sicko book. So truly, I cannot be stopped. And the terrifying thing is I don't know what's going in Doom Spiral yet, which is our Q3 like September this year release. And I like Dark Souls, so anything could happen, you know? I don't know. I truly am unaware of what majesties I could inflict.
No, you know, yeah.
But it starts from ultimately, like, because if you're committed enough to your bullshit and you market it and you price stuff effectively for what the thing is trying to be, right? Which might be very expensive level for extremely luxury thing orders. You have to buy a lot of it for it to make sense. You can get this stuff and sell it to people and have it make sense. And like, it's very, I really like having that idea of going, no one's done this before. I mean, people obviously have put holes in books and made cassettes for role-playing games, but like, no one has done it with the vim and gumption with which I have approached these things in successive intensity. I just really like weird shit, gang. I really just like weird little things. I like being my little guy with my nest full of freaky books and cassettes and dice made out of brass and stuff. But like, you know, eventually my aspirations will run out, but I have more plans.
I don't believe that for a fucking second, actually.
Sorry?
I said, I don't believe that your aspirations will run out. I think in 10 years, you'll be making some kind of sicko shit we haven't even imagined.
The way you describe books and like the stuff that you like to do and like the book sicko dumb that you ascribe to reminds me, for whatever reason, of Penn Jillette of Penn and Teller, the magician, has a definition of magic that I really, really love. And it is magic is just someone spending way more time on something than you think is reasonable to expect. But what I really like about that is that not only is that like very true, like me having worked as a magician in the past, it's like, yeah, it is kind of true that like if you see a magician and you think the only way they could possibly do that is that they memorized all 20 of those decks of 52 cards, that's probably what they just fucking did. Like they probably did the thing that you think is way too much work and way too much time, way too much effort to actually do. And what I like about the corollary of that quote is that like, if you spend enough time on something, if you go deep enough and if you go way past people's expectations, it can kind of become magic. Like when you spend, like if you look at, you know, I'm looking at Morkborg is on my desk. When you see that and you look at it, you're like, oh my God, all the time that went into this. Or when you look at Orbital Blues, all the time and all the care that went into this, it elevates the project and it makes you feel like this is a magical object. I must open it. I must learn what it is. And that's not to say you can't get that with a zine, but like when you see that physical manifestation of the game becomes something so much more, it just makes it so much easier for you to open up and be like, you know what? I bet you there's magic inside this.
Mm. Wow. I love games. I love game books. I love a book that makes me just like, as soon as I pick it up, it's like, oh, fuck, I need to actually take this home with me immediately.
Someone made this.
And that was Orbital Blues.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was Orbital Blues at like Gen Con 2022. Yeah. Like my first ever Gen Con. I was like, oh, this is a book I need. Like, I think it was even just like the details of like the colored spine that's different from the cover is just like it's the care. It's like the idea that there's care put into it by the person who made it does show through when you're like, when you pick it up in a game store, it's like, it is the thing that gets you to hold it for that extra second. And I love what you said about like demand play, I think is such a fun like goal to have as a game designer and as a creator of game books. It's like, this book demands you play it. And that's like, I feel like that's a really strong thing to like think about as a game designer, if you're a game designer where like that's important to you, that people play your games, not only buy them, which I agree with you, I love that, means way more than just the purchase of a game that somebody played it.
I think like while I understand what is important to me, I'm not a prescriptivist in terms of what's important to other people. If you want to make lyric games or like stuff that's you know, so simple, or even like stuff that's deliberately labyrinthine to the point where maybe it isn't difficult to play it, you know? I think, you know, the campaign for North Africa may be one of the most beautiful pieces of art ever made, right? Because it's a fundamentally underperformable board game, right? 1,500 hours to complete it. You know, I think that's gorgeous. That's magnificent. But in a way that, because it is inherently hostile to play in the way that it exists, right? But equally, you know, I'd rather just play Twilight Imperium, you know, which I can get done in a weekend. You know?
Right.
And even then, that's not an approachable game, don't get me wrong. And I haven't played Twilight Imperium because I'm not a nerd. But,
you know. Yeah, no, no one would ever accuse you of being
no,
a,
no, no, no.
That'd be crazy.
What are those kit-bashed Warhammer figurines in the background?
Genuinely, I'm just too busy playing Warhammer to play Twilight Imperium. But you guys have seen my toy soldiers, right? I've showed you pictures of my Adeptus Titanicus models made out of bones and seashells. Right?
Yeah, I follow your mini Instagram. Yeah,
so sorry. Yes, thank you. There is a Muppet Makes Minis. Those of you that appreciate slightly weird art in 28mm and sometimes 8mm scales.
I didn't know this existed. I will have to follow this.
Yeah, it's a good one.
So you know, I think about that type of effort of things that go into something as like that is a way to create magic, and you do it with books, and I think a lot of the things that we do with My First Dungeon and with Bitcherton is like we do that with our actual plays and with our podcasts. And like my hope is that by throwing in a crazy amount of post-production and sound design and effort and care, that we create something that has that little bit of magic that makes you excited to listen, makes you excited to then like buy the game and stuff. And so I'd love to pivot over to a question for you that I don't know if we've ever like super gotten into this, us and you. Soul Muppet has sponsored a number of seasons of My First Dungeon, including our multi-award winning Orbital Blues season, our recent season of Paint the Town Red, and upcoming a one-shot of the latest game, Mad as Hell.
And you were our first sponsor.
Why do you think it is important or valuable for gaming companies and publishers to invest in actual play? And what do you think about that investment as a long-term thing?
Yeah, so I think one of the things that is really important to me is that actual play, even beyond podcasts, would have formerly existed in streams or theaters or whatever, is at its best, it is meant to be aspirational media, right? It is something that like, oh, you can play this game because look at this group of people playing it, right? And that acts as a toolbox for like telling you how to play the game as well, like giving you an example of what a well-played, well-thought-out game of this looks like. And, you know, there's lots of different types of actual play that exist, like, and there's different spectrums, like live stream stuff exists at one end of that spectrum, right? And the other end is the really highly polished, like almost quasi audio drama edited stuff that you guys make, right? And ultimately for us with the sponsorship, a lot of people play Orbital Blues or Best of Braid or whatever it is on a stream or whatever, but the kind of stuff that you guys provide, like the USP there, is the stuff that exists at the other end of that space. For me, I wanted to work with someone who did those kind of actual plays, who was really excited about our stuff and our games, and you know would have been interested in playing them anyway. I think that the moment that I was like sold on you guys as a partner to work with was actually literally when you sent me that list of Orbital Blues spaceships. With a like, we'd like to work with you. Here's what we did on the drive home from Gen Con, 500 spaceship names, which is a hell of a pitch to wake up on a Tuesday morning in Chicago.
Just in case anyone hasn't heard this story real quick, we hung up with Zach at the Roan, Rook, and Deckard party at Gen Con one year, and they briefly mentioned that like, oh, hey, if you ever come up with some spaceship names, send them to us. And so on our 12-hour car ride home from Gen Con, we sent a list of 500 spaceship names.
Yeah.
To okay. Someone we had yeah. very little interaction with. Like, this was unhinged behavior.
She hung out a bit, but like,
but not these guys again?
500,
yeah.
Yeah, not that many. Not 500 spaceship names. Yeah, no, I think that the enthusiasm for the thing is really good. And ultimately, for me, a really good actual play exists as like an asset that I can, and again, there's me like talking about how I think capitalism shouldn't exist and then describing you guys as a really powerful marketing asset. But ultimately, it's something inspirational and aspirational that I want to push towards people. And it helps. It is also like a really nicely edited and, you know, group of charismatic people telling a really beautiful story that is meaningful and interesting. But also the fact that I can use it to show people what playing the game actually looks like. And there's a reason that in Afterburn, I point towards the AP as something that I think it did cool. Like we use that hyperspace nostalgia mechanic. And also I put one in the Paint the Town Red book as well. There's also like a a push towards your guys' stream, because I want people to read the book, understand that your thing exists, and then go look at it, right? And that's never going to be a million people, but it's about pushing things towards you guys so they can see it and then understand that this is something they could do, right? And ultimately, while like the really cynical reason that the sponsorship exists is like the AP wouldn't be able to be as made with as much incredible time and budget as you guys throw at it, and it might not exist otherwise. Supporting artists is nice as well, but if I hadn't have bought this, I would have spent X thousand dollars on art instead, probably, or, you know, bought more books. I don't know. But it's a good tactical way for me of like wanting to inspire people to play the game, especially because I think the stuff we make does really well in actual play, because it pushes towards like strong character and emotional storytelling. And also, when you do it right, all the Booze and Paint the Town Red are also really funny, which is like an important thing I don't think I realized until Chinook wrote that article on the Your Guys newsletter. And I was like, oh, yeah, no, this game is hilarious when it happens in the right way, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that one of the things that can go wrong with RPGs is like somebody looks at it. Somebody thinks that like, oh, this is a really serious game about being really sad. This wouldn't be fun to play, right? And that is a pit trap that a lot of people fall into when thinking about some other games. And actually, like, I don't think that's true at all, but obviously I'm the creator, so I'm biased. Being able to push somebody towards like something that contains as many belly laughs as it does gut punches, emotional gut punches, because it's good storytelling, is a really incredible asset to have for me as a games publisher. Yeah. So I would encourage, if you have an RPG line of middling popularity that you think could do a really good actual play, you should reach out to these guys and sponsor them for some stuff, you know? Although,
yeah.
And the more you do it, the less time they'll have to work with me, and then, you know, they can charge more, and then the world is better, you know?
Yeah.
I love to work with people to the point where I can't afford them anymore. You know, that's like one of my big aspirations. So, you know, pay someone until I can't, and that's fine.
It is funny because, like, this idea of like books that demand to be played, I think that is the subtle, or like the subtext of My First Dungeon, is we want to make actual plays that make it so you feel like it's demanding you to go play the game we had, because like you can see how good a story we're able to tell, how much fun we're able to have playing it. So then, like, go play it immediately.
So, Zach, as we kind of like come to a close here, the last thing we want to talk about is the project that is currently live as people are listening to this, which is Mad as Hell. Can you tell people, give us the pitch, what is Mad as Hell, where can people find it, and why is this project a Soul Muppet game?
So Mad as Hell exists because me and my friend Evie Moriarty really hate capitalism and the way that it exists and the way it commits colossal violence upon the people involved in and victim to it. Mad as Hell is an anti-capitalist demon hunting RPG. You play a group of radicals who are a member of leftist, but not explicitly always leftist, communities within the same urban area. Within the world that we live in, violence exists, and it is often quiet violence perpetrated by the people and the systems of capitalism upon marginalized communities. And when those specific local violences occur, a demon appears for a wound in the world. The demons in this game are specific to a violence that occurs against a specific community, and they relate to and look like and are a part of those violences. You might have a demon of gentrification within an urban area. You might have a demon of food deserts. The one that's included in the quick start is a creature called the Pipe Leech, which exists because of lead piping in rental housing. It's part of the leech choir of demons that all exist because of the actions of landlords. The way that you fight a demon in Mad as Hell, you don't just punch it in the face or that will do something. You work out the demon, the violence the demon is created by, and then you apply to the demon the thing that could fix that problem in real life. You might hit the pipe leech with a lead-safe pipe, or put it through a water filter, or, you know, do any of these things which are designed to, like, stop the problem of lead water in housing or mold or anything like that. Spray, mold spray, breach, whatever works. That might kill the demon, but the demon's going to come back unless you solve the violence against the community. Bore the pipe leach, that means getting those pipes replaced. Either you're doing it, you're finding someone who can, or you're, you know, getting the landlord to do it, which can happen in lots of ways, which I will not publicly incite violence against landlords on this podcast. Oh God, I just publicly incited violence against landlords on the podcast. Oh no, I'm sorry.
Hypothetically.
Hypothetical landlord violence. So the way you actually kill these demons is not by fighting them, it's by fighting them and then going out into your community and making meaningful changes and performing direct action. Mad as Hell exists because we want to provide a safe and lightly fictionalized environment for people to practice direct action and learn the techniques and tools they can use to do this thing we are currently talking about in an abstracted land of fantasy demons and monsters in real life. I want to teach you how to be able to go to a protest. I want to teach you how to commit violence against a landlord. I don't know.
Hypothetically.
There's lots of... Hypothetically. I want to teach people how to become... I think it's important to say that a lot of people like have left-wing feelings and they have sympathies with unions or marginalized people or, you know, victims of violence. And they often don't know how to solve this problem and what they can do to affect change in the world. And what this game is meant to be is, you know, a practice zone, a safe space where you can, with your friends, work out how to save the world. But actually, so it's been written by my incredible friend, Evie Moriarty, who wrote a bunch of stuff for Paint the Town Red. And we've sort of collaborated on this game. It is lavishly illustrated by, amongst others, Scrap Princess and Per Norden, who have done an amazing job. You can download a quick start of it right now, as well as backing it on the crowdfunding project, which you should do, please. But you can download a quick start. You can also download this thing we made called the Radicals Handbook, which is an in-world zine made by other radicals that contains advice in it on how to play the game and like what a demon is, what violence is, and what tools you have as a person to affect it. And because it's like an in-world artifact, it includes commentary by different leftists within the setting, right? So it's presented as like a something that demands play, right? It's an object which I can hand to you physically, and then it contains the instructions on how to play the game. Not the rules, because those don't really matter. Like, what the game is and how it's played and what it means, right? So it's part of Soul Muppets' tradition of play-first games, you know? And hopefully that play then meaning something in the way that all of my games, because all my games are about politics, ultimately. Sorry, everyone. You have to know who I am and what I'm about if you've read any of my games. You can ignore the subtext if you want, but most of the time it's just text.
Particularly with this game, yeah.
You know, Inevitable exists because I think maybe the monarchy isn't great. You know, Orbs of Booze exists because of my contempt of capitalism and because of mental health as a self-employed person. Best Left Buried is much the same, except it's about having a job. Paint the Town Red is about me and my relationship with my sexuality and my gender and substances and how that relates to how I feel queer communities are. Yeah, we've talked about many of these at length, but these games exist because I have lots of feelings and I cannot stop them from coming out. And an RPG has been the most refined way I've worked out of putting those feelings to paper. Because writing poetry is hard, guys. Writing dice mechanics is way easier than learning like iambic pentameter or something. And then selling RPGs is only a little bit harder than writing them. That's not true. It's really hard. But you just got to do all the stuff I've been talking about.
It's all the things.
Yeah, Mad as Hell is cool, and it's really important to me and to Evie and to the team that have worked on it because, like, this is the game by which I feel Soul Muppet has the most opportunity to make a positive change in the world and maybe deal with some of that stuff I was talking about earlier surrounding uncertainty and the hellscape of the modern political landscape.
And of course, people can get this book sicko bait of the double die cut hardcover on the Kickstarter right now. What else can they get on the Kickstarter, and like how long do they have to go support this project?
We are launching, will launch, have launched on International Workers' Day, May 1st. And we're running for about a month. So you have until the end of May to get this podcast out and also buy this game once the podcast is out. and there is the main book, which is, you know, the sicko book as described. We've got a zine, and there's a couple of other bits and bobs that like are still in the process of finalization, but there's some stretch goals that I cannot talk about yet and may be able to talk about by the time that we are live.
Hell yeah.
So yeah, if you're listening to this and you want to know, at Jelly Muppet on social media, or like join the Solo Discord or something, and there'll be people talking about it all the time. Or should you read the product page?
And we're also going to put the links to the quick start and the zine and the Kickstarter campaign as well in the show notes. So if you're thinking you want to check out any of these things, check out the show notes, click on the link you want. Zach, as we move to a close, we have one last question that we like to ask everybody who comes on Talk of the Table, and that is, what are you bringing to the table? And that is just our cute way of asking you for a recommendation of anything. A person, a game, a television show, a book, a resource. It can be inside of tabletop. It could be outside of tabletop. What's something you'd want to recommend to our audience?
Oh, I've got to hit you with a sicko war game thing. The thing I would recommend is going onto the internet and checking out a war game called Necropolis. Necropolis is made by a guy called Owl Shield. It is a sort of spooky, it's the most OSR war game I've ever played, and it involves a bunch of like skeleton zombies. You need miniatures for like maybe 4 to 6 guys depending on the army you're running, and it's played on a really small board, like 16 by 16, so you don't need many minis, you don't need a big board, you can literally play on a kitchen table with some stuff, and it's super fun and accessible, like necromancers killing each other. And like the modeling community is really cool for it. And I think it's like a great way to play a weird war game. Because I think the problem with a lot of war games, and I play a lot of war games, if you can't tell from the fact I was showing you all my Warhammer models before this and talking about aspirational media, that war games do an absolutely terrible job, unless it's Warhammer 40K, of convincing you that this is a real game that you could play and you could achieve doing it. Because like you got to find an opponent who's got a painted army as well. And I think like starting with something really small and incredibly accessible is like the best way to do it. So play Necropolis on like the smallest possible table of 16 by 16 inches. Like a Warhammer board is like 72 by 48. So it's like 1/14 Warhammer board or something, you know. So yeah, I'll give that a shot.
Thank you so much, Zach, for coming to the table. Do you want to let people know where they can find you online if they're looking for you?
Cool. So yeah, my name is Zach. I am the Jelly Muppet. You can find me as such on many servers. The company whose books you've been hearing about, if you've not got it already, it's Soul Muppet Publishing. We make stuff like Orbital Blues, Paint the Town Red, Best Death Berry, Inevitable, Mad as Hell is on crowdfunding right now. You can find our books on our website, soulmuppet-store.co.uk. And we are available on many social medias at Soul Muppet or Soul Muppet RPG. Some places we couldn't get Soul Muppet. Everything we make has a free quick start. So you can always get... Oh, that's the other thing. I should have talked about this earlier. Play forward, quick starts, free. You can get it to the table immediately. Look at me doing segues back to something we said 25 minutes ago. But yeah, we are Soul Muppet Publishing. And you should check out our games.
And if you want more gaming content from us here at Talk of the Table, you can join the Many-Sided Newsletter, the Many-Sided Media Discord, where you can talk about this and all of our episodes, and Jelly Muppet is in that Discord. You can also support Talk of the Table on the Many-Sided Media Patreon, where you get ad-free episodes, bonus roundtables, a whole bunch of other fun stuff for this and My First Dungeon. Please rate, review, and follow Talk of the Table wherever you get your podcasts, and that's what the table is talking about. Bye-bye, everybody.
Bye-bye.